just listening, trying to still himself. After 30 seconds, he felt himself become one with the building beneath him. He felt the rush of the cold wind on his cheek, listened to the high shriek of a bus somewhere in the darkness below, a car horn. He opened his right eye and dead-centered the reticle on the window. "Ready. Hit it now," he said. Chapter 37. The Brit came awake to a pulsing flash of light on the wall of his hotel bedroom. There was a low boom, then light was shaking the room as a rattle of firecrackers went off close by.
"Oh, what in the world, fireworks? Is it some Yank holiday?"
his wife said, already sitting up and looking toward the pulsing window.
"Oh, maybe it's the anniversary of that horrid little park. It's coming from that direction, look."
The assassin checked his Rolex on the bedside table.
"Maybe," he said,
as another skyrocket popped softly outside the window, shivering the walls of the suite's living room with the pale green light.
"Oh, it's pretty," said his wife,
who was still quite tipsy from all the wine they'd had that evening at the Four Seasons.
"Let's see if we can get a better look from the living room. Maybe the hotel is doing it. Call down and see what it is."
"Just go back to sleep," the Brit said. "You know the amount of work we have to do."
"You and your work, please, for once, would you let us have a little fun?"
"Fine." The Brit got up and walked out the bedroom door. Two more rockets burst in the air as he crossed to the kitchenette's dark quartz island where he'd left his phone. Then two more exploded right at eye level, a yellow one and then another green. He smiled. He loved fireworks. Who didn't? It would be lovely to hug his wife and watch them. Enjoy one of those rare happenstances that entirely make a trip. He found the concierge's number on his phone and thumbed it as he walked toward the window, the dark room glowing strangely in the billowing colored smoke and streaks of light. Chapter 38. In the cold air rush, Matthew lay breathing evenly, watching the window through the nightscope. There were other people now at the hotel windows, some of them taking pictures as Sophie's pack of skyrockets continued to streak at a slow and regular interval straight up from beside the park central statue. He could feel his heartbeat thump as he watched 809's floor-to-ceiling window kill zone, the curtain, the end of the couch, the painting.
"Come on," he whispered. "Come to Papa."
"That's the last one. Any sign?"
said Sophie, as a big rocket burst into a yellow and red flower. In its afterglow, Matthew watched, waiting, finger on the trigger.
"No, damn it, nothing," he thought.
It wasn't going to happen.
"Tell me you have something," said Sophie.
"Negative."
"Maybe he's dead asleep or something," she said. "What do we do?"
"We go back to the drawing board," he said, packing up. Matthew was about to turn to go down the ladder when the round hit him. It caught him about 4 inches below his brainstem, just above the center of his shoulder blades. Its impact knocked him flat, face down, as if somebody had yanked out his ankles from underneath him. He came to a skidding stop halfway off the elevator housing, and he just let himself topple the rest of the way into space, just in time to get missed by the next suppressed shot that blasted brick bits and tar paper between his boots. He smashed hard into the roof, bashing the shit out of his elbows and the top of his head and his ribs as he landed on the XM-24 in the clunky kit bag. Knowing he was safe, he pulled his backplate out. The indent in it! He shook his shirt and caught the big and still hot mushroom bullet that had been meant for his heart and just stared at it. The bastard must have run up to the hotel's roof, which was level with Matthew's perch.
"Hey, I'm in the car. Are you coming?"
Fear hit him almost as hard as the bullet. He imagined himself running down the 12 flights of stairs just in time to see the prick lighting up Sophie. But he calmed himself and calculated quickly. What would he do if he knew he was being ambushed? Attack or hold position? Hold position, definitely. The Brit might have spotted him, the sly bastard, but he didn't know what kind of operation he was up against. No way would he run from cover.
Matthew, are you okay?
Fine, he said after a few labored breaths. He looked at the plate again and shivered.
Fine, baby. Be there in a shake.
Chapter 39. The telescoping stock of the rifle gave off a satisfying job-well-done snap as the Brit, crouching in the dark on the roof of the Gramercy Park Hotel, collapsed it with the calloused heel of his palm. He hid the new matte black Belgian FNFAL with its suppressor and state-of-the-art night vision scope under his fluffy white hotel robe. Then, still in a crouch, he slipped silently off the darkened hotel roof back through the stairwell door. Padding quietly down the hotel's back stairs in his bare feet, he thought he very well might have hit the prankster on the roof of the nice building on the other side of Gramercy Park. And with a hefty 7.62 by 51 millimeter NATO round, he'd more than likely gotten his attention. Who had it been, he wondered. Not the coppers. Company, then? Someone else? Definitely someone in the business by the looks of the hardware they had. Whoever they were a little sloppy. Fireworks? Then he thought about it. Maybe not so sloppy. He had, after all, almost gone to the window. Plus, the fireworks were pretty. It was almost elegant in a way, like a birthday party, only the opposite. A little light show before they cut his cake once and for all, the bastards. When he got back to his room, he put the gun away in its case and called Pavel, who had hired him. It kicked into voicemail. Had Pavel turned on him for some reason? He pondered the implications of that. Should he leave now, he thought, as he went into the bedroom? No. If it were company or anybody else in the game, they'd want him out on the street at night to keep it discreet. He took an OJ out of the mini-fridge beside the bed and cracked it and took a long sip. He nodded to himself. To heck with it. He'd check out in the morning, like a regular human being.
Well, said his wife when he got back into bed, what was it?
The Brit thought about who would want to kill him. Then he laughed. He'd be up all night.
I don't know,
he said as he snuggled in next to his wife. He kissed her above her camisole, right where he'd just shot whoever it was who thought he could pull a fast one on him.
Well, aren't we so tender all of a sudden? What was that for?
Love, darling, he said as he pinched her bottom. All we need is love, right?
And rockets,
she said after a moment, and they both began to crack up.
Chapter 40.
Now finish up the rest and don't screw it up, Flicka said, stabbing one of his long fingers in Marvin's face. I know what a gram looks like in my dream, so you think about skimming, you think again. I'll go down and get the car. You'll be in the lobby waiting when I come around. Don't make me text your ass.
Marvin waited for Flicka to leave before he let out a tense breath and looked around at the spare room. The table, the electronic scale, the massive mound of rank marijuana.
What the hell are you doing?
He whispered to himself. The apartment was in Flushing, Queens, near LaGuardia Airport, with planes screaming overhead every 5 minutes. Flicka had taken him here 3 hours before and set him to work, busting down a couple of pounds of weed. This whole thing was all over his stupid cousin. He just had to get into weed dealing with Flicka. But he messed up stealing money or losing product and got shot dead by Flicka. And now Marvin had to do Flicka's bidding to pay off his cousin's debt, like some sort of slave, or else his poor uncle down in North Carolina was going to get it too, from the other guys in Flicka's crew. Marvin had been trying to think of how to get out of the situation, but so far he was coming up empty. What the hell could he do? Maybe he could ask the family living here in the weed apartment for advice, he thought, shaking his head at the insanity of it all. The apartment belonged to some Asian people, apparently. A grandma, it looked like, and a three-year-old and a baby. As he sat busting up the last of the weed, he watched as the grandma walked obliviously past the open bedroom door and headed into the hall bathroom. Did Flicka have a deal with them or something? Marvin thought. Was the mama-san some sort of crook? He had no clue. Marvin finished bagging the last gram and stuffed everything into the knapsack, along with the scale. When he came out into the hallway, he almost stepped on the three-year-old who was sitting there in a diaper, eating one of those long ices in a plastic sleeve, which would have been way weirder than it already was had the apartment not been so stiflingly hot. The ice was a blue one, and the stuff was stuck to the little guy's face and neck and chest. He was just covered in it. Marvin winced as he stepped over him and headed out the door.
What you waiting for? I should get out and hold the door open for you?
Flicka said as Marvin hit the sidewalk.
Get in!
Flicka was in his Escalade now, what he called his company car. The inside of it smelled more like weed than a lawnmower smells like cut grass. Marvin got in and put on his seatbelt and looked around for cops. About 10 silent minutes of driving through the maze of Queens later, they pulled into the parking lot of a Stop and Shop supermarket and parked.
Go out and get me one of them carts,
Flicka said with a jut of his chin.
What?
Marvin said, staring at him.
You deaf? Get me one of those carts.
One of the shopping carts?
What other kind of carts you see, boy?
Flicka said.
Get one and put it in the back. And flip it when you put it back there, too. I don't need it rolling around, ripping up my upholstery.
What the hell now? Marvin thought. After 20 more minutes of driving around, they pulled into a storage locker joint beside a U-Haul rental place. Flicka parked and ordered Marvin to take the shopping cart out of the back. Marvin followed as Flicka rolled it inside the storage facility. They took an elevator up to the second floor and continued down a seemingly endless hallway lined with corrugated steel lockers.
2162, here it is,
Flicka said, undoing the lock on one of the steel shutters and rattling it up. Inside, it was jam-packed with moving boxes and kids' furniture and bicycles and clothes, box after box after box.
We gotta get all this out to my sister's new place in Camden,
Flicka said, handing Marvin the lock.
Fill up the ride with as much as it can hold and then come get me. I'll be in the diner across the street.
Marvin stood there staring at the boxes.
It's official. I'm a slave, he thought. There's no way out of this.
Ah, don't look so sad, little Marvin. This here's what's called a character building exercise,
Flicka said, grinning.
If you get tired, don't worry. Just think of your uncle's smiling face, and everything will work out fine.
Chapter 41.
It was a little after 9 o'clock at night, and Manhattan College's dratty gym was hot and bright and packed to the rafters. The gym was an old 70s-era airplane hangar-looking building that was sometimes criticized by visiting sports reporters. But when the Jaspers were playing their closest rival, Iona College, the fans' electricity in the joint could have outdone what you'd find at a Knicks game at Madison Square Garden. Over the squeaks and squeals of sneakers on hardwood, blasted the arena standard, "Get ready for this," as Manhattan's band and cheerleaders and dancers and student fan section, Sixth Borough, went batty. They weren't the only ones. Myself and the rest of the Bennett bunch were at the top of the bleachers at half court going berserk as we watched my son Trent compete in the halftime hijinks.
Go, Trent, go!
We chanted. He was trying to put on an oversized Manhattan uniform and complete a layup while a rival little kid fan tried to get on the gear of the Gales. Trent was in the huge green and white Manhattan uniform, half a step ahead of the Iona kid, when he got tripped up by the size 13 sneakers he was wearing and fell down in a heap.
No! We yelled.
But then the other kid tripped as well, as Trent got up and calmly banked it in.
Yes! We yelled.
Wahoo! Seamus yelled, and started handing out high fives as we jumped up and down. I turned as Mary Catherine, wearing a Manhattan College hoodie, planted one on my lips. We stared at each other. "You look beautiful in green and white," I said after a beat. "I bleed green and white," she yelled. I was still laughing when Brian tapped me on the shoulder. "Dad, look, it's him," my son said. "Who?" I said. "With Marvin down there," Brian said, pointing at the gym entrance. "That scary guy I was telling you about." I looked over. There was a tall, older guy in an expensive goose-down jacket talking to Marvin. The guy looked formidable, both in size and attitude, and Marvin looked afraid of him. I decided to take a walk down out of the stands to see what was going on, but by the time I got to the entrance, the guy was gone. "Hey, Marvin, there you are. You made it," I said as I stepped up. "We were getting worried. How did your, after-school history project go?"
"Oh, hey, Mr. Bennett," Marvin said.
"Yeah, it went great." I noticed that Marvin smelled like weed. Make that reeked. He didn't seem high, though. If anything, he looked relieved to see me. "Marvin, who is that guy, the guy you were just talking to?"
"Nobody, an old friend from my neighborhood."
"You sure? You didn't look too friendly."
"I'm all right, really, Mr. Bennett," Marvin said as he passed me, heading for the stands.
I decided to let it go. For now. Chapter 42. The private study down the hall from the Oval Office, where President Buckland held many of his more under-the-radar meetings, had a pale palette of cream walls and pastel high-back chairs and yellow chintz sofas. When the president walked in at 6:30 a.m. with his personal secretary, Mattie Holzer, his first thought was that Ellen Huxley Laffer, his pale, waspy national security advisor sitting on one of the yellow couches, fit right in with the decor.
"Good morning, Mr. President," Ellen said, tucking away her smartphone as she stood.
"Morning, Ellen. Hope that wasn't a Snapchat," the president joked as he sat on the couch across from her. The president liked Ellen. Wearing an immaculate Saxon gray blazer and skirt, the sandy blonde former captain of the Harvard Law debate team looked like a middle-aged Ralph Lauren model. But her stock soap actress looks aside, the 54-year-old was about as well-rounded as one got in D.C. intelligence and Department of Defense circles. She was a National War College graduate and a former air attaché to the French embassy, as well as a CIA case officer.
"Can I get you anything? A bagel or a muffin?"
"No, I'm fine. So what's up, sir?" Huxley Laffer said.
The president took a deep breath. "Okay, Ellen. I heard from the others last night about the Ukrainian economic collapse. Are you up to speed on that?"
"The hryvnia, their currency, is collapsing in value, right?"
Huxley Laffer said. She had read about it on Bloomberg on her way in.
"Yes, it's completely tanking, down 24% in the last 3 days. We have a friendly high up in their Department of Finance, as you well know. They've tapped us for a loan to stop the bleeding. I'd love to go forward with that, or anything else that will help the Ukraine stand up to the Russians after their annexation of Crimea. What's your take?"
Huxley Laffer looked up in the air to her left and pursed her lips as she thought.
"I think, truthfully, that we need to back off a little, Mr. President. You know, calling them out on that false flag attempt last week was a really good move. It was very effective and needed to be done, but I think a loan or any other direct backing and involvement in the Ukraine on the heels of it is really going to be seen seriously as a threat to some of the hardline higher-ups in Russia."
"You think so?" the president said.
"Well, we know through our sources that they're already spooked by the increase in a military budget you made. And besides, we already have economic sanctions and help from our European friends to limit trade and especially credit to them. We have enough pressure already on them. It's time to let it do its work."
The president squinted pensively at Huxley Laffer. "So let this one go?" he said.
"Yes, sir. I think you should let this one go."
The president smiled. Slow and steady wins the race?
That's what they say, Huxley Laffer affirmed.
On another topic, you think I should go to New York for this UN summit?
What does John say?
The president rolled his eyes and smiled. The head of the Secret Service? What do you think?
They're still looking for the shooter?
The president nodded.
What do you want to do?
Go, of course.
I agree,
Huxley Laffer said.
Show of strength, Ellen.
Yes, Huxley Laffer said with a smile. Then she lifted a finger.
But remember, not too much.
Chapter 43. With its old gray pre-war tenement buildings and rusting fire escapes and garbage bags piled high at the curbs, Brighton Beach, Brooklyn looked like a dilapidated chunk of inner-city blight plopped down beside the ocean. Noon Tuesday, I was in a Fed surveillance car in the heart of the heavily Russian neighborhood on Ocean View Avenue. In the car with me was Paul Ernenwine and two of his best guys from the FBI New York office's Russian mob squad. A second car with two more agents sat around the block. The object of our attention was the gaudy red and gold awning of a popular Russian restaurant called Sochi's that was a block to the north. We'd finally gotten a decent lead. The feds had scoured Pavel Levkov's Riverdale place while he was still at the hospital. They'd found a cell phone in a false panel in the attic, and one of the numbers on it belonged to a well-known Russian mobster named Maxim Kuznetsov. Kuznetsov, in addition to being a former professional heavyweight boxer, had been a suspect in over a dozen brutal murders of Russian nationals and Russian-American immigrants in the last 10 years. He had ties through his older brother to Russia's military intelligence organization, the GRU. He was also one of Sochi's owners. As we sat there staring at the restaurant, it started to lightly snow. You could see snow on the boardwalk down the side street and even a half-melted snowman on the beach under the lead-colored sky. Call me crazy, but whenever I hear the word beach, it usually evokes images of sunshine and pastel-colored hotels and bikinis, I said. Yeah, well, welcome to Siberia by the sea, Paul mumbled as he looked through his binocs. Wait, he said a moment later. There's a car slowing down out front, a BMW SUV. Paul's radio crackled.
We see him, it's Kuznetsov, said the feds in the other car.
Busboys were Windexing tabletops and a vacuum whirred loudly from somewhere as the five agents and I, in raid jackets, stormed into the restaurant 10 minutes later. There was gold everywhere, on the covers, on the chairs, the brass railings, and the mirror frames. From the gilt ceiling hung massive glittering chandeliers that were about as demure as Cleopatra's earrings. We found Kuznetsov in the very clean and bright stainless steel kitchen. He was a tall man, about 6'4", in his 50s, wearing an apron over a stylish white dress shirt and gray silk suit pants. He was expertly chiffonating clusters of basil on a butcher block with a 10-inch chef's knife.
Maxim Kuznetsov, Paul Ernenwine said. The beefy, gravelly, handsome, dark-haired man glanced up at us, then slowly set down the huge knife. He blotted out his broad forehead with a paper napkin. Something good was cooking in a pan on the stove behind him, some kind of chicken in a thick brown butter sauce.
Yes, can I help you?
He said in, surprisingly, completely unaccented English.
We'd like to ask you a few questions about a national security matter, Paul said. Could you come with us, please?
He stared at us steadily with his dark eyes.
Will I need a lawyer?
He said. Paul smiled.
I guess we'll just have to see, he said.
Chapter 44. The next morning at around 10, Paul Ernenwine and I were walking south down Brighton Blustery Park Avenue, heading to a surprise meeting with the Secret Service at their forward team HQ. The invite was quite sudden, and even more curious since this was the very same Secret Service who'd said they'd wanted to run their own separate departmental investigation in the search for the president's shooter
instead of teaming up with us.
So I heard our Russian friend Kuznetsov didn't bite, I said to Paul as we crossed East 31st with steaming donut cart coffees.
You heard right, the stocky Boston Irish FBI agent said as he pulled up the sleeve of his trench to check his watch. We released him around 11 p.m. when his lawyer showed.
He maintains that he had no knowledge of Pavel Levkov, and that his number on Pavel's phone could have been from any one of the patrons in his restaurant to whom he claims he often loans his phone.
So that explains his connection to the attempted presidential assassination, I said, rolling my eyes. Just a simple case of loaning out a cell phone? Our bad.
Don't worry,
the feisty red-headed agent said with a grin. Before we let him go, we let it be known that we were going to put a full court pressure on him and his entire organization until he decides to be more cooperative. He didn't exactly seem to be shaking in his boots, but we'll see what happens.
Up the block, I followed Paul into the marble lobby of a pre-war office building, and we badged our way past the desk. Through a buzzed open and unmarked door on the eighth floor, I counted about 24 stressed-out T-men among the laptops and file cabinets and paper shredders. Paul said hello to one of the agents, who led us to the back of the office. Inside the briefing room, a dark-haired woman sat at a desk, biting on a pen as she stared alternately at the two laptops open in front of her.
Paul, Mike, I'm Margaret Foley. Thanks for coming, the tall, attractive, intense 30-something brunette said as she stood and smiled and shook our hands.
Paul had already told me that Foley was the service's newly assigned agent in charge in New York. He'd heard she was supposed to be a pretty straight shooter, ambitious but fair. Her people seemed to like her. Foley gestured at her laptops.
I'll be blunt, fellas. We're getting absolutely nowhere in our own investigation on the president's shooter, and I was hoping we could maybe pool our resources in tracking him down. Does that sound like it makes sense?
Yes,
Paul said as he unbuttoned his coat.
Finally.
Foley laughed as she rolled up her shirt sleeves.
Yeah, I heard my predecessor didn't play that well with others. I'm hoping I can change that.
She uncapped a marker with a sharp pop and brought us over to the whiteboard she had set up in the corner.
Okay, maybe you can help bring me up to speed on all this, she said, gesturing at the collage of printouts and photographs.
Basically, the morning the president came to the UN, the FBI New York office got a call from a confidential informant, Paul said as he sat down. Our counter-intel division has had a pretty high-up guy in the Russian embassy for years who we trust. He told us 6 months ago that he heard a rumor that a big hit was about to go down in the States and that it was being authorized by the Russian government, but he didn't know the target. Then the morning of the president's visit, he called, frantically saying he had just found out it was the president.
That's insane. Just incredible, Foley said. Do the Russians want a world war? Who's the shooter supposed to be? A Russian?
Now, we think the Russians probably opted for a professional killer for hire, Paul said. Why bring one of your own people in when you could use a world-class sniper turned mercenary?
Where did you come into all this, Mike? Foley said, turning toward me.
I was put on a task force with Paul's guys on the morning of the president's arrival to find the shooter. It didn't take long. I was part of the aerial counter-sniper surveillance covering the presidential motorcade coming in from Kennedy, and as we came into Manhattan with the motorcade, I spotted something under the lip of the MetLife building.
The sniper's blind, Foley said,
tapping the crime scene photos on her board that showed the blind.
Okay, so you crash-land on the roof and attempt an arrest, but the assassin shoots the cop with you and escapes. Then what happened?
A Russian confidential informant from the embassy went missing, Paul said. But not before he gave us a lead on a guy named Pavel Levkov.
Levkov? Foley said, pointing to a picture of him.
That's the guy who was shot in the kneecap?
One and the same, I said. We think he was the shooter's handler. We also think that we're not the only ones looking for the shooter.
Who's the guy Kuznetsov that you picked up yesterday? How does he fit in?
Kuznetsov's the head of the Russian mob in New York, I said. We found his number on Levkov's phone. What makes things even more interesting is that Kuznetsov also has ties to Russian intelligence. He has an older brother in the GRU, the Russian Army's military intelligence.
So, more Russians again, Foley said, shaking her head. We figure maybe that Kuznetsov got the order from the Kremlin to do the hit, then hired Levkov as a middleman to hire an assassin, I said.
It's a theory, at least, Paul said with a shrug. We actually had a talk with Kuznetsov last night, but his lawyer sprung him after 10 minutes of getting nowhere. We have surveillance on him and Levkov, so hopefully something will break.
What's the deal with the president? I said, peeking out the meeting room's blinds.
I looked up at a jaw-dropping view of the Empire State Building 2 blocks northwest, then back at Foley. It was getting cloudy now, darker, threatening to snow.
Is he actually coming back for this next round of UN meetings? I said.
Margaret Foley popped a cap back on the marker.
We advised against it, of course, since this shooter might very well still be around, she said.
She clicked the marker to the magnetic whiteboard and crossed her arms.
But the president insists. He's stubborn, she said.
Stubborn, Paul said, as he drummed his fingers on the table.
Sounds like our job just got a whole lot harder, I said.
Chapter 45. The British assassin entered the Holland Tunnel from Manhattan to New Jersey at a little after 12 noon. It began to snow lightly when he came out of the tunnel. He turned up the heat in the rental car, a Chevy Camaro LS, which she thought would be crap, but it was actually surprisingly nice, fast, comfortable, and quiet. He drove through Jersey City and got off I-78 before the Newark Bay Bridge. At a Shell station on the opposite side of the exit ramp, he stopped and went in and bought a cold bottle of raspberry lime seltzer that he drank as he checked the address again on his phone. After he had his bearings, he sat patiently, sipping his refreshing beverage as he looked out at the traffic on the exit ramp for another few minutes. He'd already made several maneuvers to deter surveillance, but you couldn't be too careful. Things were looking positive for a change. He'd been able to establish contact with a new representative for the client last night, and everything was full speed ahead again. Regrettably, someone had tortured the information regarding his whereabouts out of his handler, Pavel. They didn't know who this inquisitive person was, but they were thinking perhaps a member of the CIA, as the torturer seemed to know a lot about what was going on and was an American. He thought about what had happened at Gramercy Park. Whoever was after him, he was confident he could handle it. The client apologized profusely for such an unfortunate incident, and, in addition to getting him a new handler, offered compensation for the screw-up on their end in the form of a 50% increase in fee upon completion of the job. Being a good sport, the British assassin had readily accepted the apology, and, of course, the money. It was the least he could do. One never wanted to disappoint so gracious a client. Drinks and thoughts finished, he pulled out of the gas station. 10 miles and minutes later, he pulled off 440 onto Pulaski Street near Port Jersey Boulevard. He passed along a couple of football field lengths of chain-link fence with shipping containers stacked behind it before turning into a parking lot. The low, ugly brown brick building he parked in front of had the words Fleet Line Rentals above the door. There was a security camera bolted to the brick beside the sign, so he pulled a blood-red Washington Nationals ball cap low over his eyes before he got out of the car. Spa music was playing softly in the small reception area inside. The office was quite dingy, but in one wall sat a plate glass window with an open view of the Manhattan skyline across New York Bay.
"Can I help you?" said a middle-aged woman from a windowed slot in the scuffed sheetrock wall after a couple of moments.
"Yes, I spoke to Mr. Rodriguez this morning. My name is Peters," the British assassin said, with a perfect Midwestern American accent. "Is he around?"
"He's on the phone. If you have a seat, he'll be more than happy to help you when he's done."
As he waited, he took out his phone but decided not to fiddle with it. He was trying to quit that nasty modern habit. He turned it in his hand as another atrocious spa song began. He stared out at the distant lower Manhattan skyline, the
the ugly new Freedom Tower standing out like a broken tooth. As he watched, two tugs appeared close offshore, pulling a bulk freighter through the Claremont Terminal Channel.
"Mr. Peters," said Rodriguez, suddenly standing beside him. He was a heavy, very pale, bald Hispanic man with striking hazel eyes.
"Mr. Rodriguez, thanks for meeting with me," the British assassin said, shaking Rodriguez's soft, gold-ringed hand.
"Well, thank you for waiting," Rodriguez said,
swiping away sweat from his forehead as he nodded rapidly with a little smile.
"I had one of my guys bring her up this morning so you could take a look right away, if you'll follow me."
They went out back. Parked in front of a five-vehicle bay of garage doors was a 50,000-pound tri-axle Caterpillar dump truck, blue in color. It looked far bigger than it had in the online ad, the British assassin thought, concerned. A real monster. Maybe it was too big. He took a slow walk around it.
"How old?"
2011, but it runs perfectly," Rodriguez said.
"Listen."
He nimbly climbed up and turned it over. It coughed once and again, and then snarled to throaty, rumbling life.
"Sounds great," the assassin said. "You need it for a month?"
"Yes," the assassin said.
"Tell me, off the top of your head, how wide is it?"
"Did you say wide?" Rodriguez said, squinting at him. The British assassin smiled, nodded.
Standard width," Rodriguez said with a shrug. 8.5 feet, same as a tractor trailer."
Excellent, the British assassin thought. It would be snug, but it would fit.
"Shall we start the paperwork?" asked Rodriguez hopefully.
The British assassin smiled again.
"Yes," he said. "Let's."
Chapter 46. Around 2 on Wednesday, Doyle called with news on a Rafael Arruda drug hit that he needed to share with me in person. 30 minutes later, I found him and my other protege, Detective Lopez, in Washington Heights' 33rd Precinct's second-floor break room. With a grand flourish, I placed on the table, between the styrofoam cups of wretched coffee they were nursing, the plastic bag I was holding, and removed the two huge waxed paper soda cups and perfectly greasy white paper bags that I just brought them from Shake Shack.
"Eat, gentlemen," I said, "and talk."
"We'd hit a brick wall in the investigation, Mike," Doyle said between bites of his double cheese with bacon. "No witnesses, no nothing. So we decided to go back and look at all our video that faced the street near the drug building 2 weeks prior. I mean, it was just hours and hours of nothing. I was thinking we could market the tape as the breakthrough cure for insomnia when we saw him."
"Who?"
I said.
"This neighborhood guy," said Arturo, smiling. "His name is Saul Badillo, but everybody calls him Jinete, which means like jockey in Spanish, on account of he used to be a horse trainer or something when he was younger."
"Saul's one of these hang-around guys you often see in an inner-city hood," Doyle said. "Divorced, late 50s, lives with his grown daughter. He's sort of a super's helper, runs errands in local stores, deals a little weed on the side. He's in and out of the barbershop every 5 minutes. He patrols the block the way a beat cop does, but instead of enforcing the law, he more likely helps the friendly neighborhood crooks break it."
"Exactly," Arturo said.
"In medieval times, this guy would be like the town crier, a fool. He shuffles around 24/7 and acts like he's half homeless or crazy, but meanwhile, he knows everything and everyone on the block. He's like the block's memory, its underground eyewitness news anchor."
"Go on," I said, smiling. "I like the sound of this."
"Anete was actually one of the first guys we canvassed," said Doyle. "Of course, he said he didn't know anything, but then we saw him in the video. 2 weeks prior to the hit, plain as day, he puts a camera in a car parked across the street from the drug building."
"The camera was pointing right at the building?" I said.
Doyle nodded, sipping his shake. "So you're thinking he was working for whoever killed Arruda?" I said.
"Not thinking," said Doyle with the wink.
"We're knowing he was involved. We spoke to Jinete again 2 days ago. We showed him the video, and he finally broke down and told us everything.
So who hired him? I said excitedly.
Doyle took a printout from a folder. It was a blown-up photocopy of a driver's license. Some blonde guy on it, Matthew LaRue, it said, with an address in Soho.
Henete said this guy LaRue gave him money to rent a car and the camera and $5,000.
The guy gave Henete his name?
No, Arturo said. Henete said LaRue called himself Bill. He said he was a slick guy, spoke fluent Spanish. They met several times. But like I said, Henete is no fool. He likes to know who the hell he's working with, so he actually had his daughter secretly follow the guy after one of their meetings. She followed him all the way back to Chelsea.
Chelsea, I said. I thought the address on the license was in Soho.
Chelsea is where this guy, LaRue, has an art gallery, said Arturo, wide-eyed.
He must have gotten bored perusing the canvases, so he decided to up and slaughter a drug gang. I looked at the photo, a tingle beginning in my stomach. This was good. Damn good. We were finally getting a break.
Did you speak to LaRue?
No. We wanted to talk to you first, of course, Mr. National Security, Arturo said.
We do good or what, Mike? Said Doyle, smiling.
No, I said, taking out my phone to call Paul Ernenwine. You did amazing.
Chapter 47. A reporter was doing a cutaway to get the United Nations in the background when Matthew and Sophie came up the steps on Ralph Bunch Park onto East 43rd. It was morning, just after rush hour on Thursday, and the pair was on the hunt. They didn't look like it, of course. Idly wandering around on the sidewalk in front of the flag-draped United Nations Plaza on First Avenue, clutching maps and a zoom-lens Nikon, they looked like a young, stylish, maybe European couple, touring the Big Apple for the first time. As they walked west on 43rd, a street cleaner came down the street, churning a cloud of dust onto a rack of city bikes before it made a U-turn. In the distant haze to the west, the green, copper, cathedral-like roof of Grand Central Terminal could be made out, and above it, the lip of the MetLife building, where their target had set up his blind. This morning's question was, where would he set up his next one? Matthew thought, frustrated. After their first attempt at taking out the British sniper had failed, it was all about outthinking the assassin now and outmaneuvering him. They needed to find this bastard, Matthew thought. Find him and put him down once and for all. Sophie bought a half pint of blueberries and some almonds and dates from a fruit seller on the corner of 2nd Avenue. They crossed the street and stopped and stood, chewing beside a payphone kiosk, silently watching the passing pedestrians and traffic on the avenue.
Okay, what are the motorcade routes again? Matthew said, after he finished his nuts and berries.
All right, Sophie said. From the Waldorf to the UN, you have 4 avenue blocks and 7 cross streets. Because of the length of the motorcade, they hate making turns, so usually they cordon off 50th or 48th and take it all the way to blocked off 1st Avenue and down several blocks south to the UN's entrance.
Well, that's the most direct route, but they have to have alternatives, Matthew said.
Well, they could do Park to 46th first, but that's about it. They have several dozen vehicles, Matthew, and they need to get cross town as quickly as possible.
It'll be 50th, 48th, or 46th then where the next attack will come, Matthew said, nodding. That's where the motorcade is most vulnerable, where it could be boxed in.
Do you still think it'll be an attack on the motorcade itself?
Yes, he's tried the long shot, it didn't work out. He'll want to be closer this time. Point-blank range, maybe, or ambush with the use of some sort of explosives. He needs to change tactics, that's what I would do.
You're right, said Sophie. He's got everyone thinking long-range shot now, so it's time to switch up the script. Go for an up-close-in-your-face surprise. But how? The president's car is impenetrable.
So we're told, said Matthew, looking at her bleakly. Remember that they said the Titanic was unsinkable. We need to expect the unexpected.
What do you mean?
Call it a hunch, Sophie. Intuition. I know this guy. He's a perfectionist.
Winning is everything to him. War inspires artistry, and this guy truly thinks he's Michelangelo. If he can't do this with pizzazz, he won't do it at all.
But from where, Matthew?
Sophie said, looking up at the millions of windows.
Where will it come from?
Matthew smiled and put his arm around his wife's waist and kissed her. That's what we're here for, baby. We're the dream team. We're the hunters who hunt hunters. We'll find him.
I don't know, Matthew. Maybe we're in too far this time.
We take it the whole way, babe, Matthew said, just like we decided in the beginning. We have to find this fool. We have no choice.
But what if he finds us first?
Sophie thought, but didn't say. Chapter 48. My just-popped can of Diet Coke hissed along with the old radiator in the corner of the small dark room as Paul Ernenwein and I sat in a too-warm, windowless, secure comm room in a nondescript FBI building on East 56th. We were on the fourth floor just down the hall from Paul's office, sitting on metal folding chairs and watching a flat screen. On it was a live feed of a blonde couple walking west up East 43rd Street. The two were an attractive pair, a weather-beaten blonde guy in his late 30s and his pretty, platinum blonde wife, probably 5 years younger. The guy reminded me of that laid-back dude on the HGTV show Fixer Upper, only he had a ridiculously muscular Olympic gymnast body, a slim waist with broad shoulders, and huge forearms and hands. The couple was being videotaped with a zoom lens from over a block away by one of Paul's guys in a state-of-the-art surveillance car that looked like a taxi minivan. The van and feds had been on them since I'd sent in the lead the afternoon before. They were also up on their house and cell phones. Despite the tourist getup, they look like professionals, don't they, Paul? I said. Just the way they move, heads up, relaxed, yet alert. Also, the way they keep a lot of space between themselves, almost as if they don't want to reveal to anyone watching if they're actually together or not.
They're operators, all right, Paul said, nodding. Who leaves their primary cell phone at home in the middle of the day?
That's tradecraft. As was the super slick way Matthew hired Hinete in Hamilton Heights, I said. Intelligence Service Asset Recruitment 101.
Though they're trying to appear to be tourists, Paul said. Watch how even as they look up at the buildings, they don't stumble or bump into people. You can tell they're familiar with the area.
These guys are analyzing, fact-finding. They're in mission mode. You think they're scoping out the motorcade route?
Could be. Mike, you saw the shooter. Could this guy be him?
I stared at Matthew LaRue as he walked with his wife.
Maybe, I said after a bit.
Same athleticism, same build. I'd already read through the extensive info folders Paul and his team had put together on Matthew and Sophie LaRue from the Fed databases. It turned out they weren't your regular art gallery owners. In fact, they were both ex-CIA. They'd met in 2005 in Iraq, where Matthew, a former Navy SEAL-turned-Special Operations Group team leader, and Sophie, a CIA analyst, both cycled into the Joint Special Operations Command. What they had worked on together there was classified, but Paul had spoken to some people at State and speculated that they had both been ground zero in the insurgent terrorist hunting business. For 4 years, they had worked side by side, gathering intel and finding and fixating and terminating jihadi bomb makers in and around Fallujah and Mosul. When Matthew was a SEAL, he'd actually earned the Distinguished Service Cross, one medal below the Congressional Medal of Honor, for almost single-handedly suppressing a truck bomb attack on a forward operating base in Bagram. He and Sophie had married in 07 and had put in their papers at the same time in 2011, when she had gotten pregnant with their now 4-year-old daughter, Victoria. Matthew was a hick from rural Indiana. So it was Sophie who was wearing the pants in their somewhat successful art gallery biz. Sophie was a born and bred Manhattanite with a father who had apparently been a famous gallery owner. They didn't seem like assassins, but then again,
We had every indication that they had been involved in the hit in Hamilton Heights. And now, they looked like they were casing the streets between the Waldorf and the UN, where the president would be driving around in less than a week's time. It was concerning, not to mention scary as hell.
Is this even possible, Paul?
I said as I watched them.
This can't be what it looks like. Two former distinguished and dedicated patriots now working for some unknown enemy, actually setting up our own president?
I watched the good-looking couple on the screen as they took another picture.
It seems weird to me too, Mike, but anything is possible, Paul said. Maybe they've got money problems or a drug habit, if you consider how wackadoo the art world can be. Or maybe they picked up a crazy ideology. Couples do go nuts sometimes, and these guys were deep in the shit over there in Iraq. For years, all they did was eat, drink, hunt, and kill people, and sleep. These people are definitely persons of interest.
Chapter 49. At a minute before 5 o'clock that evening, I found myself at Riverbank State Park in Harlem, listening to Katy Perry sing about fireworks from the cranked-up ice rink speakers over my head.
"Dad, what do you think of my moves?"
said my son Ricky, excited as he wobbled past, almost falling 3 times.
"They're persistent, son. Real persistent," I said, wondering if I should fetch him a bike helmet from the van.
A moment later, Fiona and Julia and Jane sailed past on their skates quite gracefully, their elbows locked as they sang along with Katy at the top of their lungs. I joined them for a few bars from the sidelines, until for some reason, they told me to stop.
"What's the problem?" I called after them with mock concern. "Wrong pitch? No, wait, it's my key, right? Where are you going? Wait, I can go higher."
The annual skate-a-thon fundraiser for my kid's school, Holy Name, was officially underway. As an official ringside lap counter, I was freezing, but it could have been worse, I knew. Instead of my kids, it could have actually been me out there, falling and scraping and clunking against the boards over the Zamboni freshened ice. Though I was dog-tired from our all-day surveillance, I couldn't pass up the chance to spend some time with the kids. I'd been working too much lately on the joint task force. Way too much, if you considered how little there was to show for it. And the fundraiser really couldn't have been for a better cause. Catholic schools were truly hurting due to low enrollment, closing all over New York as they were all over the country. The thought of Holy Name actually closing was too depressing to even think about. Everybody at the school and the parish was like family to us. Speaking of the saints, I busted Mary Catherine beside me, staring at me as I put down my clipboard and lifted my not-so-hot cocoa. I smiled at her warily as Katy died out and the All-American reject started up.
"What?"
I said as she continued to stare without saying anything.
"Nothing," she finally said with a small grin. "It's just nice to see you like this."
"See me like how?" I said. "Dry and on solid ground instead of out there sitting on the ice with a wet, red, sore, frozen butt?"
"Oh no, that actually might be cute," she said with a wink. "I meant happy, relaxed, and, as a bonus, actually here."
"I'm here all right, Mike Bennett in the frostbitten flesh," I said, blowing on my hands. "Too bad we can't say the same for Brian and Marvin. Where are those two? It can't take that long to get here from Fordham. They should be here by now." I saw Mary Catherine wince with worry as I said this. I knew she was already quite attached to our new house guest and considered him to be family. Besides, she was no dummy. Like me, she knew full well there was something up with Marvin, something that for all intents and purposes seemed to be heading from bad to worse. How do these damn kids become such experts at worrying parents to death anyhow? I said as I took out my phone to text Brian yet again. The second they outgrow the playpen, it's over. Chapter 50. Brian Bennett took a quick peek at his vibrating phone as he stood at the greasy window inside a Chinese takeout dump called New Dragon Palace on Westchester Avenue in some misbegotten,
run-down section of the Bronx. He looked up from his dad's latest freak-out of a text and put his eyes back on the car underneath the elevated track across the street. It was a Mercedes, a two-door glossy silver E320, ghettoed out with big silver rims and dark-tinted windows. He'd been doing nothing but stare at it for the last 10 minutes. It was because of Marvin. Marvin was now in the car, doing who knew what with that old psycho gangbanger dude who seemed to be stalking him. This wasn't supposed to be happening, Brian thought. What was supposed to be happening was Brian and Marvin attending the Holy Name Skate-a-thon with everybody at the rink in Harlem. But after school, Marvin said he had something to do and would meet him later. Brian knew what that meant, so, on an impulse, he decided to follow him. It was quite the odyssey. The B train at Fordham Road to Yankee Stadium, the 4 train from there to 125th, where Marvin got a third train, and Uptown 6, that had taken them back into the Bronx here to a place called St. Lawrence Avenue. He didn't know what St. Lawrence was the patron saint of, but his street was one of the sketchiest blocks Brian had ever set foot on. Coming from the stairs of the subway, he'd passed an auto glass door that looked like it had been torched beside a bodega with a bulletproof glass sidewalk kiosk. The only light on the dilapidated block seemed to be from the blood-red neon Petey's Discount Liquors in front of which the Merc was parked. It didn't make sense, Brian thought, shaking his head. Marvin was the coolest dude. Enthusiastic and humble and nice to everybody, parents, even freshmen. A solid B student, with his athletics, he was a shoo-in for a good college scholarship. He even